Call meeting order. 3:20, this is the cast committee. Quorum is present, Representative Cato, Representative Byrne, and myself. We have before us House Bill 384 and House Bill 385, establishing and funding an Alaska Native Child Welfare Task Force. Representative Fuller is not here. I'm a co-sponsor of this legislation, and I can just give some preliminary comments. In my previous employment, I've been involved considerably in the implementation of the federal Indian Child Welfare Act in Alaska. It is a federal act that, if it is at all possible on the federal level to say it, it is an act that slipped through. There was frank amazement by some of us who supported the issue that it was able to be adopted. And in fact, once it was adopted, it was such a strong act, took such a strong position on issues of protecting Native families and Native children, that it was apparent that it was going to require major changes in the procedures used in the state of Alaska and around the country with regard to Native children. It's been my experience that many of those necessary changes have been fought tooth and nail by people who were required to implement those laws, most specifically the judicial system and to some extent the social welfare system, although they seem to be more sympathetic. At any rate, it is a major change, or a major intrusion, if you will, of the federal government into affairs that are traditionally those of the state. It is because of the federal relationship with its native people. It's clearly justified in my mind, but it does has created its intentions within the state with regard to compliance with it. I am familiar with a number of those changes and feel that we need to take some sort of rational action to view what changes need to be made in legislation, administrative procedures, judicial procedures, in order to adequately implement the federal Indian Child Welfare Act task force that, in my view, with some modifications, would go a long way toward doing that.
President, Mr. Chairman, are we going to have some testimony on what those things have existed of? I'm not familiar with it.
The plan here is to take testimony until 4 p.m. or 5 minutes to 4, and then because we're not able to have teleconferences in here anymore because we wore it out, I guess, we have to adjourn to the governor's conference room, I believe, where a teleconference is awaiting us at 4 o'clock to receive other testimony
on this
legislation. So it would be my expectation we'd go now until 5 minutes to 4 here, break, adjourn again at the teleconference at 4, the expectation that will terminate about 5 o'clock, depending on how many witnesses there are. During that testimony, I expect that you'll find the answers to some of your questions. There is a copy of the Indian Child Welfare Act in your packet. With that, who wants to go first? Mr. Pugh, you want to go first? Okay. Put your hand here.
I'm John Pugh from the Division of Family and Youth Services, supporting the Department of Health and Social Services today, representing the Department of Health and Social Services. The department would like to go on record as supporting House Bill 384, 385. The department, the Division of Family and Youth Services, has been most significantly impacted in the department in terms of the Indian Child Welfare Act. The division is responsible for the removal and placement of children under state laws in terms of child abuse and neglect. And of course, the act is most definitely a significant change in the way in which states are required to proceed in terms of dealing with Native children and their families in the area of child protection. The department has worked with the task force in the last year. We have a lawyer at our training center, Myra Munson, who's been participating with the task force over the last year, and we feel very strongly that the task force is one way in which to develop more understanding about the act, as well as coming up with recommendations of procedural changes that need to be made both in the judicial system as well as the executive branch. In recent years, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, the department, as a result of the act and prior to the act, as a result of a lot of the testimony of individuals from various Native groups around the country as well as in Alaska, had begun to change its way in which we dealt with Native children. For example, placement of adopted children in adopted homes in the last 3 years. The department's record has been 80 to 90% of those children each year, infant children, have been placed in Native homes. The only placements now, it's an exception for Native child to be placed outside of a Native home at this point. The only children that are being placed outside of a Native home are hard to place children, and those children who have been in lengthy foster care arrangements where they have made a significant bind with that non-Native family. And those are becoming less and less as the time goes from when the passage of the act was. The biggest problem that still remains, well, two big problems, but in terms of placement, which is the area that the act hits the most, the placement preferences, the foster care placements are still a very significant problem around Alaska. In Northwest and Western Alaska, Northwest representing Nome, Barrow, Kotzebue, and then Western Alaska being what we look at as Bethel region and all the surrounding villages, we have a very close to 100% placement with Native families. And there's not the problem of placement in the sense of outside the preferences of the act. But when you get into Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Ketchikan, it drops way down. It's not even 50% of Native children are placed. In fact, the norm is to place Native children outside of Native homes. And we have worked with Cook Inlet Native Association, Fairbanks Native Association, and Klinkin-Haida in the last couple of years of having foster home finding projects and attempt to develop Native foster homes. In general, those combined efforts have not been real successful. We do have more Native homes than we had before, but we're still way short of the amount of homes necessary to meet the intent of the act, which is every child should be placed in a Native foster home. Finally, I think just to say that the end point really, and I think in the act, in some ways, the act is reversed. The way the act is dealt with is they deal with judicial procedures and placement preferences first, and then finally they come to prevention. And it's kind of an interesting way. I think the reverse would have been a better way to place the act in terms of intent. The most important thing is trying to prevent the breakup of Native families, and that's what the money as far as flowing from the federal government to Native organization is to develop family service systems which hopefully can prevent the breakup of Native families. And I think, again, that in terms of preference for me, that's the most important issue that the task force has to deal with, is how can we, as jointly, Native social service agencies, the state social service agencies, and other interested individuals, be able to begin to stop the breakdown of Native families. And I think that the task force has a large job. It's not just in terms of procedures. It's in terms of the very fabric which holds together families, and particularly Native families. And I would say that that's the most important thing, and we in the department are very interested in participating in the task force. We feel that we have a lot to learn from the Native organizations, and we feel strongly that a coordinated effort in this task force could make a real difference for Native children and their families.
Okay, thank you. You said 80 to 90% of infant Native children are now being placed in Native homes.
Okay, now I should qualify that. That's state adoptions, and that's only 30 out of the some odd 500-600 adoptions. The rest of the adoptions, as you're well aware, are done on the private market in Alaska. So we do not have those statistics in terms of what is the
they, but don't you do investigations on private adoption?
No. Usually Catholic Charities will do some of them. If we are ordered by the court, and there are some instances, particularly in Western Alaska and Northwest Alaska, where the court, there are very few private social service agencies, the court will order us to do them. But generally statewide, we're not, we're ordered maybe a dozen times a year to do studies. So we have very little knowledge of what the, you know, the overall arena is.
So what you're saying is the numbers are so small that maybe the percentages are hard to...
Yeah, what I would say is that what I'm looking at is kids who are actually relinquished to us, or else their parental rights are terminated, or the children that we have for placement adoption, and we've been averaging around 30 a year. And from that standpoint, in infants, we probably have, I think last year's statistics, we had 19 infants last year that we placed. And so the numbers are very small.
Indeed.
When you can, right, when you consider overall that there's 500, 600 adoptions in the state, anywhere between 500 and 600, a number of those being step-parent adoptions, but still that many of them, there's a large percentage that somewhat fall outside the purview of the department. And in that sense, I think it's very important that judicial procedures be looked at, since most of these adoptions are being done on the private market, and there has not been as much of an interest or cooperative effort from that group of people in terms of this act. No.
How does the ratio, or 80 to 90% of infant native kids that are in state adoptions placed in native homes, how's the ratio work for native kids that you get under your care who are not adopted out, that are in foster homes?
Okay,
what
I was saying,
in homes,
right, in the foster care arena, which would be foster care placements, and Western Northwest Alaska, Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and Barrow, we're close to 100%. The last time we ran those, we ran anywhere from 95 to 100% on placements of Native children in Native foster homes. And when you get into Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and Ketchikan, it runs it runs anywhere from 25 to 40%, depending on what the availability of foster homes are, but in some time may even drop below that. It is not... It's dropped significantly down. It's a real difference.
What were those percentages like before the act was adopted?
Well, I think that one of the interesting things is that the percentages on adoptions was probably around 50%. It was not that high. On the foster care percentages, I think they were already, prior to the adoption of the act, had already begun to reach very close to that in Western Alaska, the 100%. The regional managers that we had out there prior to the act were very supportive of Native home placements. But in the adoption arena, I think there's been a significant change as a result of the act. Very significant change. Again, I can't speak for all those other, all the, the hundreds of other adoptions.
I guess I'm surprised that the foster care seems to be working in rural areas. A complaint over the years has been the difficulty of being certified as a foster home in rural Alaska. Is that, in your perception, still a problem?
That has, in the last three or four years, has not been a problem due to the waiver procedure. There has, as far as to my knowledge, in the 2.5 years that I've been in central office, there's never been a waiver denied. And normally the foster home workers, as well as Native organizations who have done some work in finding foster homes, we usually work with them on the fire extinguishers, smoke detectors, things, and there's always organizations who will contribute to place those in people's homes. But in recent years, that has not been a problem at all.
So there are waiver procedures that take into account,
right,
difficulties with room,
sure,
size.
For example, double exits, that's always a problem in rural Alaska, and that there's waivers that take that into consideration.
So in your view, licensing of foster homes in rural Alaska is no longer a problem?
That has not been a big problem recently. Yeah. And in fact, it shows in our institutional rates. The lowest institutional rates in our system are out of the rural areas. Much higher institutional rates in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and so on. And that's somewhat of a philosophy, and you know, I think rural Alaska deals a lot better in terms of being a community placements, really working hard, relative placements, that kind of thing. When you a lot of Native families who are from a small village come into Anchorage or Fairbanks, there aren't family, you know, so there's not the ability to really work together with family for placements and that kind of thing.
Okay, so that's the source of the problem. And
right.
In urban Alaska, you're having problems because there just aren't enough people to apply to be foster care.
Correct. And I think Jenny can testify somewhat to that on Klinkahaida here. A very strong, same kind of difficulty in just finding family. It's been very hard. And we've never been quite clear, and that's part of why I hope that it's an area the task force deals with. We have not been able to come up with the reasoning of the difficulty finding Native foster homes. And I think that's something that needs to be studied quite a bit. We don't know whether it's a financial situation in terms of we're not supplementing income enough with foster homes or what that is.
Any other questions? Hmm.
How about Ketchikan? They only run, 50%, you're saying?
I think they run lower than that. They run about 25-30%.
These children are either adopted or else they're just placed in a foster home.
Most of our placements are temporary placements under 2-year custody orders. Well, in the sense that the court orders the child removed because the parents are abusing or neglecting the child, and the division is ordered to work with and try to rehabilitate the family and place the child back in the family. So they're, in a sense, hopefully they're temporary placements. They're temporary until we can get the family in shape to have the children placed back. So the children are placed in, rather than native homes, in the larger cities, the norm is to place in a non-native home. Because we do not have native foster homes, enough native foster homes to go on.
I see. The primary purpose of the act is to place children into foster homes.
When we have to place, the primary purpose is try not to place it, as I mentioned earlier, and try not to place at all, and that's the major focus. But when you have to place, then to place in a home of like culture. For example, if you have a Tlingit child, to place in a Tlingit home. If you have an Eskimo child, to place in an Eskimo home. And so that the cultural background can be matched up, and the parents will be sensitive to the native heritage of the child. And in the past, there has been an insensitivity to that at times, the culture. And I think it's even more important, I've sensed land claims, and I think in terms of Representative Clarkson, you asked the changes. I think land claims had a significant change in the way that Alaska dealt with Native Alaskans. I think that began to make a significant difference because the department had a real obligation in terms of funds for children, which you're aware of. And I think that made, in some ways, that in and of itself made a significant turnaround in thought processes about how important it was for Native children to have Native ties. And I think that from that standpoint, we still see that. It's very important that there be a connection in terms of the village and so on, because of village disbursements, there's a whole lot of things. And then if we go back to older cases, you'll find a lot of times where parents never even bothered to sign kids up for land claims, didn't search that kind of thing. There was no real look at the heritage of the child.
Any other questions?
No, I think so.
Okay, thank you.
Francine Eddy.
We're going to have to try to hold this to 15 minutes or so for the other witnesses here so we can get up to the telephone.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Francine Eddy. I'm a social worker with Klinkit-Haida Central Council with your child welfare program. And I'm presently vice chairperson for the current Alaska Native Child Welfare Task Force. I would like to, at this time, provide testimony on behalf of the task force in support of House Bill 384 and 385. given the beginning of the testimony, when Mr. Pugh presented, I sent some, you know, what you shared in terms of not really being clear as to the act and to what it entails. If it would help assist in understanding the, in putting into perspective 3D, 4, and 3D5, give a historical overview as brief as I can, if that would.
Unless President Byrd wants it, I'd be anxious to move along.
Okay. I mean, she can pass over it.
Okay. Yeah, because that's basically that item number one does give a clear historical view. To focus directly in terms of the effort of the task force, I would like to address a few areas in terms of the intent of the task force. The establishment of the task force would ensure statewide representation from each of the regions, Native regions. I think that's crucial, as I'll move into, as well as the task force can make an assessment of the implementation of the Act in Alaska. I think, again, that's crucial when you're dealing with 12 different Native regions throughout the state, as well as the 13th region, which is the South 48. And I think more crucial, too, is for Alaska in establishing and endorsing a task force is to take a state leadership in comparison to the nation of really addressing how are we implementing the Act in Alaska in terms of cultural sensitivity to the different cultures we have here in our state. I think to pinpoint areas that I feel the task force can address in within the year, more crucial as a child welfare worker, one of the areas we have seen around the judicial area is the notification process in terms of the Indian Child Welfare Act. In Alaska, technically, there is anywhere from 254 to 256 IRA and traditional village councils that are designated as tribal agents to receive notice on Indian Child Welfare matters. In other words, the state goes through the Bureau, and the Bureau has to notify the tribal agent in reviewing child custody proceedings that are Native children. Which then clearly looks at a question of jurisdiction. And I just wanted to ask a question
on the setup of the tax force. I know it's the present of the time. I was quite surprised to notice that almost all the people on the task force are women. There's only about 3 men, am I right?
You could, yeah.
And I was curious as to that makeup. I'm not sure it's pertinent, but in a way I'm rather curious. Could you explain that to me?
What you see the makeup of those that are on the existing task force are those that are working with grants, Indian Child Welfare grants under the Act. And most of those are women employed in those positions.
It's a very unusual spread, is what I'm saying.
But that is why those that make up the membership that you see there are those that are employed within each of the Native agencies directly with child welfare, and they aren't happy to be women.
I'm going to try to shorten this up
if I may, by
asking a number of questions about potential changes. I am concerned about the period of time we have, and I'm a strong supporter of it. I think that I would guess that there's not much question that this bill is going to come out of the committee. So if possible, I'd like to move to some questions about the wording of it.
Okay.
In House Bill 384, on line 10, purpose of it is to study and recommend legislative changes. It's been my experience that many of the problems that have been experienced are being experienced in the implementation of the Act include administrative actions.
That's correct.
And actions by the judiciary to the extent that those aren't administrative actions. Would you have any objection to changing the language to clarify that it's not just legislative changes that are required to make the Act work?
No, I have no objection to it at all, because I think it's quite accurate.
As you've identified on line 14, the bill proposes a representative from each of the regional native corporations. As you've indicated, I mentioned that there is a 13th corporation. It is perhaps even more of a problem with members of the 13th regional corporation because they don't have the support systems available to them. They're scattered more than the other shareholders of the other corporations. They're scattered through the lower 48. Very often have no sense whatsoever of the provisions of the Act and the protections it provides for them and their children. We very strongly encourage that a member be on the task force from the 13th region. They got some of the worst problems, in my perception. So would you have any objection to adding the 13th corporation, 13th region?
No, I don't. And I think one of the interjectives now, on the amendments under item number, I believe it's 8, we had addressed the regional nonprofit entities being there, the ones that are, have child welfare programs rather than the profit making.
Is there a list of proposed amendments? Is that what you're referring to?
I believe it was item number 8.
Jenna, can you help me?
It's in the middle of the page.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, we got problems with that. Governor doesn't like that. Governor even tried to argue on another bill before this committee that it was not constitutional to limit his authority to who he could appoint. So there's some question. But well, your testimony is that you would prefer that the nonprofits, that the members of the task force be selected from the nonprofits rather than the profit corporations.
That's correct.
Yeah. And I understand that the Senate has reduced the number from 12 to 9, so it may not be, depending on how strongly I feel about that, that we can actually have 13 members. But if it's something less than 13 members, you still would prefer that they be members of the nonprofits.
Okay, and why I want to clarify why is at this point it's the nonprofit entities or organizations such as Cook Inlet, Clinkett and Haida, Manelik, Kodiak, that are implementing in terms of programs, child welfare programs, and they are the ones that have been involved heavily rather than the regional profit making. And that's why I make that decision.
My background in this is that I filed one of the first pieces of litigation under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was a lawsuit against the state and all of the regional corporations to require them to select custodians. Children who had been made wards of the state, Native children, they were not taking any steps to protect Native Settlement Act benefits for those children. So I agree with the task force in the sense that we didn't get much cooperation from any of the regional corporations in recognizing their responsibility to protect the benefits that go to Native children. So I agree with the idea of getting everybody all together. If I can just go down then on line 19, or I mean on line 20, 19 and a half, whatever it is, mm-hmm. The customary drafting form would be to provide that the person would be the Attorney General or his designee.
Correct. That would help.
Propose some sort of language like that. The same thing with the Commissioner of Health and Social Services and the Administrator of the Court System. I don't know how much you have worked in cooperation with Alaska Legal Services people, but I know that because of my past employment with them, that they have been very, very much involved in the legal ramifications of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Some people who are, I would consider, experts on the Act. Would there be any objection to proposing that a representative from Legal Services sit on the task force?
Not at all. In fact, at one point we did have 3 at large, and we had in our expectation to include a representative. They have, I would think, throughout the state, been very involved in child custody cases with Native families.
In addition to the administrator of the court system, and I don't know technically how you do this, but it's been my experience that the group that has been least cooperative, and I will say that having been out of the issue for a year or so, and maybe they're real cooperative now, but the judiciary has been less than cooperative in rural areas in trying to implement the Act, and in fact, the been some effort here a couple of years ago to take the legal position that the act was unconstitutional somehow, and that was a position of the judiciary. That's all preliminary to suggesting that a member of the judiciary should sit on the task force.
I think that's crucial because that issue has been coming up in court cases where that is the key question that's addressed.
Chief Justice or something, that would be a desirable addition to the task force. You would have no objection to that, assuming that we could sell it. Is that right?
No.
Chief Justice or
investigator. Right. I mean, they're the ones that matter. It cuts into
their authority. Yes, it's a constitutional issue, isn't it, right?
No, it hasn't, that I'm aware of, anyway. That's why it's such a problem. You got a judge sort of thinking something's unconstitutional, it's pretty tough to have cooperation in implementing the act. Going along, and on the sections on duties and on meetings, it seems to me that it's absolutely crucial to hold public hearings. And I'm not even sure that I would, and I solicit your suggestion on this, I'm not even sure that I would think it to be a matter left to the discretion of the task force. It seems to me that public hearings are absolutely crucial. Just raise that for your comment. I mean, I think we've got to find out there are people that will not be members of the task force that will be involved somehow, and social workers in rural areas that deal with it every day, and others. I don't know how you feel about that, but I would be inclined to require that the task force conduct some public hearings. What's your reaction to that? Tony, you want to go on the record and...
Yes. My name is Tony Strong. I'm the Director of Community Services with Clinkett and Haida Central Council. I see you've got about 5 minutes before you go to your teleconferencing, and I wanted to respond to something that you had said earlier that that will, in the administration of the idea, although the idea sounds good, in the administration of the idea it might be a little more difficult, and there are ways of meeting the concern that you've raised, perhaps under some different provision of the Child Welfare Act itself. That is the provision that the inclusion of the 13th Regional Profit-Making Corporation. They do have some difficulties down in the urban areas in Lower 48, and I do agree that there should be some way to address those problems. The difficulty will become apparent once you start trying to have those people down in Lower 48 have some kind of organization that they can go through to come and have them fly up here every time there's going to be a meeting with the implementation of the act here in Alaska. There are some provisions in the Child Welfare Act to try to meet the needs of the people living in the urban area. Those people, I mean, that would be true for people living in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Portland, and in other words, any urban area. Section 202 of the Child Welfare Act sets up authorizes grants to be given to Indian organizations to establish off-reservation Indian child and family service programs, and they would do the same kinds of functions as the implementation is being done up here in Alaska. They wouldn't have the kinds of provisions that the tribes do have. Off-reservation programs don't have the kinds of authorities that the on-reservation or native community kinds of programs can have, such as setting up of tribal courts and things of that nature. So, and then another aspect of that is if we're changing it to the nonprofits rather than the profits, then there is no nonprofit 13th region. So that the inclusion of that would be rather difficult thing to administer. Plus, we'd have a problem of in a sense trying to extend the jurisdiction of the state in this bill over to people in another state. That will create some problems. So although there needs to be some coordination with people living in the urban areas down in Lower 48, I'm not sure that having a member on the task force would provide that. I throw it out for a discussion.
Okay. again, we're running short on time.
Yeah. I know that if I raise that in the teleconferencing, it'll cause a big political problem across the state, because there are so many members of Native communities who are living in urban areas, and I didn't want to say that I'm objecting to it, but I'm saying that there are problems with the administration of that well-meaning idea.
Okay, let's take a step back then and discuss why it is we need all 12. Something we only have 12. Why all 12 representatives?
I think the intent was there is to ensure that each region is responding differently in terms of programming and how they're implementing the act, to ensure that they have some input in terms of, because technically, when the Bureau designated who the tribal agent is, that's 250-some communities, if I'm correct. And I think if you're going to exclude regions, you're excluding people that do have some, in terms of politically, tribal government for input. And I think our intent was to ensure that as much as possible that their voice be heard in terms of reviewing statewide what is happening. That was our intent.
How many of the regions have received grants?
13. And they
all 13 of them?
Not regions, 13.
Yeah, this says 14.
Right.
How many of the regions are represented in those 14 grants or 13 grants?
I believe most of them. I would say, Zach, I think there's one from each region.
Give
or take three or four.
I'm trying to anticipate the Senate. Why the Senate cut it back, one of the reasons obviously is to save a little money. And if the purpose of the task force is to prepare recommendations for actions by other bodies, be it the judiciary, the department, the legislature, whatever, it's not clear to me that it's absolutely crucial to have each of the 12 or each of the 13 represented if the purpose is just to develop recommendations. Again, I'm open, but I'm just trying to why the Senate cut it back.
My understanding why they cut it back was mainly because of the size, number, what was more functional. It was what was indicated to me.
Yeah. Okay.
9 versus 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the another part about it is that the 12 different regions, as you know, the 12 different nonprofit regional organizations that are trying to provide some kind of service to their population base within their region, all have different kinds of things, different kinds of problems they're dealing with. And to leave some of those people out would leave those problems on being not addressed. Now, one other, I know it's 5 minutes to now.
That's all right. The teleconference, I just been informed, doesn't actually start for 15 minutes.
Okay.
It takes us a while to get up there. But
okay. The one suggestion that could be made, perhaps, is that rather than going into a 13th region, in other words, down in Seattle, that the task force be charged with addressing some of the problems of the people living within that 13th regional corporations area. Because that 13th region encompasses all of Lower 48, and that's all the people who wanted to register with the 13th region. So that, and then the fact that that's a profit-making corporation, it doesn't really provide any kind of social services. So I think that just having the task force address the problems and coordinate perhaps with the Alaska Natives who are living in Lower 48 and try to see what they can do to take care of the problems, whatever way they can, that'd be a more functional way of dealing with the concerns that you may have with the people living in Lower 48.
Could I ask you, you said the Senate cut it down. Did they use any logic in cutting it down as to designate which ones would be, or just merely cut the number?
Senate has not acted. I misspoke. The committee has acted to reduce it to 6 persons appointed by the governor from nominations made by Alaska Native nonprofit organizations. So it addresses one of the concerns of nonprofits rather than profit making, but it doesn't really explain. And then the other three are the three official members.
Yet our bill calls for.
The bill before us calls for one shareholder from each of the profit of the 12 profit
One of the questions that I, either to reinforce or clarify my thinking on this, I've been thinking about this for a long time anyway, And that is that the diversity in the native regions themselves, the nonprofit native regions themselves, such as I am familiar with Otna, which is entirely different than Nana, for instance. The problems would be different. The culture, with Nana being virtually 100% native work, Otna's in a geographical location where they're probably 20% native. The problems with
right. So the problems would be different.
Yeah, and I was wondering if this is the reason for advocating the 12, because lots of times there's no communication between the nonprofit corporations. Am I correct on that?
Sure. And that's what part of the purpose of this task force, the main function of the task force, is to have that communication between the regions. And without that communication, they could end up with some conflicting results. Another point that you raised was to have the task force conduct hearings on the subject, and the provision of the 385 asked for an appropriation of $50,000. I'm not sure $50,000 would be able to permit them to have their regional, having their meetings, and at the same time have the dollars to conduct the hearings. That'd be it's a lot more expensive.
Two trade-offs there. First of all, the larger the task force, the less need for hearings. The other thing is you can do teleconference hearings. Real cheap. So I'm not answering, I'm just saying that those are considerations. We're going to go with a task force of 12 or 13, maybe we don't, hearings aren't quite as important because you got most of the input sitting around the table. You're going to go with a task force of 6 people, representatives, native, 6 native people, then maybe we're going to have to hear from the other parts of the state. That's sort of the trade-off. And the teleconference network is available. That's a great thing. Two additional questions I have. Do you have any objections to legislators sitting on this? It's my experience, let me give my little speech about interim committees. There's a tendency in the legislature in the past to adopt and set up interim committees. Legislators mixed with other people, they do a bunch of research, it comes back to a committee, no member of which sat on the interim committee, and they start all over. They start all over, they read the report, and then they start having public hearings, and they start thinking about what the report says, but none of them were members of the task force or members of the interim committee, and there's some problems with that. So the question is, what objection, if any, would there be to having legislators probably as ex officio members?
I have a question. One of the things that this task force has been doing is getting those people like Francine, who are actually in the operation of the child welfare programs. And she's I think all of the people who have been working with the task force have been those kinds of individuals. So it's a task force of a working task force of group people who are implementing the program themselves or are in the active operation of that. And my concern, the concern I wanted to raise was with these people that you'd like to have, you and rightfully should perhaps be on the task force, will that person, member of the judiciary being placed on that, will that remove one of the people who are implementing the act itself? See, that's
it wouldn't be the intent, of course, and it wouldn't do that any more than putting the Commissioner of Health and Social Services on or someone else. We have a system very similar to the system the Commissioner would have about having designees that are working members sit on. I recognize your concern that if money is the issue and the size of the task force is the issue, then we'd have to take that into account. The other question I have is, has AFN or ANF provided any money for this?
No, all the operational money comes from each region, well, each agency that has participated from their project money. Cook Inlet Native Association has picked up a lot of administrative costs independent, I mean, on their own as part of moving with the concept, but no monies have been distributed to us as a task force at all. No. All the monies in terms of travel, DM come from each agency who are in support of the concept, provide their own staff travel.
Of course, they haven't passed a resolution supporting this.
Right.
Has anybody asked them? Have they turned you down or they just haven't asked?
We have. I understand when they first were endorsed, I think that was proposed and was not
Can I respond to that? The Alaska Federation of Natives Human Resources Committee doesn't have any money. The Human Resources Committee is made up of presidents of each one of the regional nonprofit organizations. They don't have the staff, the staff to be able to do something of this nature, and there's not enough money allocated in the Bureau of Indian Affairs budget to have a statewide run organization like AFN trying to implement, help in the implementation of it. In response to that, I think that's how the task force got together, is those people within the regions who are working together are trying to work together on implementation of it on a regional basis rather than having and using the regional concerns rather than having an entity like the AFN work with them. In other words, the answer is that AFN doesn't have staff to be able to do it. They would have to put somebody on staff, and there's no dollars for them to do that. At least unless they can find some grant money someplace to do that. There are no monies provided in the Child Welfare Act that they can go after.
I'd like to also interject that the monies in terms of over this past year to get staff members together has been through the Child Welfare Grants, those that received it. It's our understanding that in terms of bringing cutbacks, that will have an impact in terms of will we have money, say, next year. I think that's another area to be addressed in terms of the need for the task force. If that money doesn't come through, then what are the Native agencies going to do in terms of programming and implementation? So that's my understanding.
The BIA General Assistance cutbacks going to affect ICWA or the task force work?
I think it will have implications. I think when you cut back general assistance in terms of what's happening within the families creates, you know, breakdown or stability within the family. So it may cause a train reaction, I guess.
They're interrelated for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have people who don't have any place to turn to anymore for any kind of support, of course they're going to have a lot more social dysfunction as a result of that. So it'll have a direct impact, but it's on the family, thereby having an indirect impact on the implementation of this Child Welfare Act.
Okay, any other questions?
Just an observation that you're sort of asking the acid question there, Mr. Chairman, about are the Natives supporting their own program? And or at least you raised the issue, but you know, I thought you did, perhaps. But the regional corporations have billions of dollars of assets, and man, they ought to be up front, you know, thinking about this type of thing.
I can't say that I speak for the regional corporations. They're profit-making corporations, and the mandate of any profit-making corporation is to make a profit for their shareholders, and if they don't, a shareholder can sue them for any activity that's not directed toward making a profit. So there's that limitation that they're faced with. Plus, a lot of the regional corporations are really not making much of a profit. There's some question of whether some of them will survive.
Okay, we have one more witness One more witness we want to hear before we break at 4:15. So,
yes, I just want to make an observation that, in my knowledge, or from what I've dealt with, the regional corporations, we tend to lump them into one, whereas there are two parts to a regional corporation, and correct me if I'm wrong, one is a profit-making corporation and a non-profit making corporation, and the two do not necessarily intersect. Am I correct on that?
Right. They're two separate entities. The profit-making corporations were set up under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The regional nonprofits were in existence prior to the Claims Settlement Act. They helped in trying to achieve the Claims Settlement Act when it was being considered. Each one of those regions had
five.
But let me make this point. Atlantic Richfield Oil Company is a profit-making corporation, yet it recently gave a $100,000 grant to something in Anchorage. So profit-making corporations do have legal authority to give money to non-profit corporations.
Yeah. I'm not saying that they don't, but I just want to make sure that we understood that they were two separate entities.
Any other questions? Thank you. Esther Clark?
My name is Esther Clark, and I'm here strictly on a personal basis. My interest with Indian Child Welfare Act came in January of 1980. It involved a grandson. I later heard about this program, which I have been involved because of my grandson. I'm not going to talk about how much we need or anything else. I'm going to strictly talk about personal basis because it's I see that it's important here. In January of 1980, a young daughter of mine passed away. She left a boy behind, 5 years old. In the Indian tradition in which I've been trying to bring my children up, my son went over to this village to get my daughter's remains and bring the boy. This was his right. Unfortunately, my daughter was married to a Caucasian who did not understand the situation. So the families, I should say, went into an uproar. We had my grandson for 1 month. The courts came and took him away. The court battle lasted almost 9.5 months, which was very costly in emotional, as far as emotionalism went in our family, and financially for my son. We finally got this boy, not because a court made a decision, but the young boy made it for them. He wanted to be with us. And in the Indian tribal system, this is the way it should have been. When a child is orphaned, I'll use the word now, but in my day, there were no orphaned children. When a child's parents deceased, and if this was a male child, the uncle took over, as was when my parents passed away. Our aunts got together, decided where we were going to go, and later after my father's funeral, we were told we were to live with this relative, which to me, thinking back on it as an adult, it helped me very much, because in spite of the trauma of losing our parents, we had a place to go where we would be cared for. I don't want to go into detail as to what heartbreak we went through for my grandson. The courts, the people do not understand the Indian culture. It is a beautiful culture, like I said. In my day, there were no orphans. There was an uncle, there was an aunt, there were relatives who would take over. With the coming of the missionaries to our shores, this part of our culture, a very precious part of our culture, deteriorated. And who were they to say that this was wrong? And now we are trying to rebuild this very complex culture to a working thing again. And it's going to take more than 2 years and certainly more than $50,000 to redo. I am trying to help where I can because it breaks my heart to see many of our children go to Caucasian families. Not that they would not have a decent home, but because they lose a part of their tradition, their culture, and their identity when they are placed other than their home. I recently heard about a young man who found his way all the way from California. They say he looks Indian. They're not sure what Indian, but somehow he found his way to Juneau, and he is only 16 years old. They don't know what Indian he is. These are the things that are happening to our children. We have a culture that will not quit, but we are losing it because we've lost this part of our culture, which is, to me, a very great one, because In my childhood life, when I was, after I was orphaned, I still felt safe. I still felt cared for. And that is the way it was. I don't want to see the number of people changed from 12 to 6, because each culture, each people, like the clans, have their own small way of doing things, and this would be depriving them of how they do things. This, in my opinion, would be wrong. The Aleut people, the Eskimo people, the Tlingit people, the Tsimsheans, their way must all be respected in everything that we do here today, because it is the reconstruction of a culture that is very important to all of the people. And as for the funding, I wouldn't like to see that cut, because I feel that if the people on the task force, and they are sincere about this, are left without financial worry, I think they can do a better job. But this is a very important part of the Indian culture of all of America that needs to be restored so that we can be a family, and I think that is what we are looking for.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, we'll recess.